Today's reading is from Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 through chapter 2, verse 10. Many years later, a new king came to power. He did not know what Joseph had done for Egypt, and he told the Egyptians, "There are too many of those Israelites in our country, and they are becoming more powerful than we are. If we don't outsmart them, their families will keep growing larger. And if our country goes to war, they could easily fight on the side of our enemies and escape from Egypt." The Egyptians put slave bosses in charge of the people of Israel and tried to wear them down with hard work. Those bosses forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramses, where the king could store his supplies. But even though the Israelites were mistreated, their families grew larger and they took over more land. Because of this, the Egyptians feared them worse than before and made them work so hard that their lives were miserable. The Egyptians were cruel to the people of Israel and forced them to make bricks and to mix mortar and to work in the fields. Finally, the king called in Shiphrah and Puah, the two women who helped the Hebrew mothers when they gave birth. He told them, "If a Hebrew woman gives birth to a girl, let the child live. If the baby is a boy, kill him." But the two women were faithful to God and did not kill the boys, even though the king had told them to. The king called them in again and asked, "Why are you letting those baby boys live?" They answered, "Hebrew women have their babies much quicker than Egyptian women, and by the time we arrive, their babies are already born." God was good to the two women because they truly respected him, and he blessed them with children of their own. The Hebrews kept increasing until finally the king gave a command to everyone in the nation. As soon as a Hebrew boy is born, throw him into the Nile River, but you can let the girls live. A man from the Levi tribe married a woman from the same tribe, and she later had a baby boy. He was a beautiful child, and she kept him inside for 3 months. But when she could no longer keep him hidden, she made a basket out of reeds and covered it with tar. She put him in the basket and placed it in the tall grass along the edge of the Nile. The baby's older sister stood off at a distance to see what would happen to him. About that time, one of the king's daughters came down to take a bath in the river while her servant woman walked along the riverbank. She saw the basket in the tall grass and sent one of them to pull it out of the water. When the king's daughter opened the basket, she saw the baby crying and felt sorry for him. She said, "This must be one of the Hebrew babies." At once, the baby's older sister came up and asked, "Do you want me to get a Hebrew woman to take care of the baby for you?" "Yes," the king's daughter answered. So the girl brought the baby's mother, and a king's daughter told her, "Take care of this child, and I will pay you." The baby's mother carried him home and took care of him. And when he was old enough, she took him to the king's daughter, who adopted him. She named him Moses because, she said, "I pulled him out of the water." So ends the reading.
Thanks, Annie. So I want you to think back to the springtime of 1977. And there was a movie released. Anyone have an idea? There's a movie that was released springtime of 1977. And apparently the studio executives did not think it was going to do very well, because you don't release blockbusters in the springtime. And you also don't release them to just a few theaters, which is what they did. Springtime of 1977, this movie proved to be a juggernaut that is continuing to go this day. That was the movie known as Star Wars. They didn't expect a whole lot from it. They would not have known that about 5 or 6 years ago, the rights to the Star Wars franchise would be sold to Disney for over $4 billion. It was just a movie to fill the theaters in the springtime. By the fall of 1977, as a junior in college, Star Wars had become a thing, and I finally was able to go and see that movie. And to say it changed my life would be an overstatement, but there are certainly overtones of the philosophy in Star Wars that found its way into my own theology. I think about the Force as sort of a defining way of God's presence in many ways more than I do other more traditional ways of defining God. Although, as Malia pointed out, the Bible tells us that God knows us. I'm not sure that the Force really knew Luke Skywalker or anyone else. But nevertheless, Star Wars captivated our imagination. Rebecca, can you put that first slide up for us? So in the fall of 1977, I was an RA in the Sarah House at Stanford University. This is the t-shirt that was created for those who were in Sarah House. And you have the three RAs in the middle. You have the resident fellows, a family, parents that lived in the dormitory, Scott and Sandra Pearson, Elizabeth and Sarah Pearson, who are now both well into their 50s. And of course, Harrison, their dog. You have all the elements of Star Wars in there. And at the center of it all, next slide, please. At the center of it all was this young, blonde, earnest boy who felt that by his very goodness, he could change the world. It was me, Luke Skywalker, without the ability to fly. 21 years later, now a father, I take my six-year-old son, Micah, to go see this movie, Star Wars, when it's being re-released. We went down to the Waikiki Theater where they spent over $1 million in refurbishing the theater because the prequels to the three Star Wars movies that had already come, much less the sequels that were still to come, were about to be shown, and they knew there was an audience that was going to watch this juggernaut. And so I took my six-year-old son. Kirsten and I had no idea what we were creating at that moment. To say that he is a Star Wars fan is an understatement. He has seen every film more than once. He has read most all of the books. He has read most all of the comic books. He speaks of Star Wars in terms of the things that are canon. Those are biblical terms, canon to the original Star Wars and those that are not. In fact, this last, about 2 months ago, he sent us a list of 40 animated Star Wars episodes that we should be watching while the new Star Wars is about to come out, Ahsoka. Anyone who's seen it, anyway, it's happening. 40 episodes of cartoons I was supposed to watch. We did not. He has. This is the world that he then occupied. Next slide, please, Rebecca. This is a Star Wars world. And he lives in it, loves it. And Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, would understand why I, my son, and so many others are captivated by these movies. They are the hero's journey. This is what Joseph Campbell says. His life work about the hero's journey says there's a hero who ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonders. If you've seen the Star Wars movies, you understand all of this. A fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from mysterious adventures with the power to bestow boons, wisdom, riches, democracy, a right way of being on their fellow humans. This is the hero's journey, which Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, and so many others. This has proven to be a boon to movie studios, the hero's journey. But it is a rather limited hero's journey, because in all of these movies, there is definitely a hero who definitely is standing for that which is right and that which is good, and is going to confront that which is evil. But it is always violent. The Disney movies that I grew up on that were also hero's journey always had that good versus evil, and good always triumphs violently and vanquishes and destroys the evil. And in fact, this has proven to be such a good formula for movie studios that we now have, next slide, the Marvel Comics universe. These are all the superheroes from the Marvel Comics universe. In the last 15 years, there have been 32 movies released of the Marvel Comics universe. My son has seen them all. And they're all about the hero's journey, except for it becomes a more and more abbreviated hero's journey, because it's really all about that which is good vanquishing violently that which is evil. And if the Marvel Comics universe is enough, There's then the DC comic universe, next slide, because apparently there's two competing worlds of comic books, Marvel and DC. So here you've got Wonder Woman, Superman, Batman. The others have the X-Men and all the other things. All violent. Good triumphs always, but violently. That's what sells. Luckily, in today's world, we have a few other images that are beginning to come our way. So next slide. In the juggernaut that is Frozen, how many of you have seen Frozen? Okay, if you haven't seen it, then you need to go see it with grandchildren or anyone under the age of 10. They can sing every song, everything in it. But the hero, heroine, in this story does not vanquish through violence, but in fact vanquishes through when her sister is about to receive a death blow. She in fact takes the blow herself. And in that salvific act, giving of herself, the world is shifted. Or there is Moana. The next slide, please. And Moana does not do violence. Moana simply, at the moment when she confronts that which is seemingly the most evil thing, instead of taking a sword or a spear, she honies. She goes up to it, she puts her forehead up to it, and in that next slide, the evil is transformed into that which is verdant and green and beautiful and lovely. It doesn't take rocket science for us to understand that there are some gender differences going on here in the way in which we are shifting the understanding of heroes. I was going to throw the Barbie movie up here as well, but that's way too complicated to get up here. Who knows what's going on when you have an anti-Barbie movie? But that's in fact what's going on. What is interesting is finally, when we have these images like of Moana or of Frozen, you begin to have images that also begin to match the biblical narrative in many ways of what a hero is. Now, let's be clear. In the Bible, there are images of the hero as that sword-slashing spear-bearer. After all, that's what the people of Jerusalem, the people were clamoring for in Jesus' time. Someone who would brandish a sword and take on the Roman Empire, one person, the Messiah, that would lead them to that which is right and good. But that is not the only image in the biblical narrative of a hero. Okay, we can take these slides off. What we have are images that are that you begin to see in a story like Annie read for us. So here we are in Egypt, in the story that Annie read for us. We're in Egypt. We are generations past Joseph being the number two person in Egypt next to Pharaoh. We are generations past Jacob and his entire ohana coming from Canaan to Egypt and being invited by Pharaoh to stay and live and thrive where the food is good in Egypt. We are generations past this time in which these two different peoples are finding their way to be together. And as Annie read for us, we are now in those generations forward when apparently the ohana of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Jacob, have been so prolific that they are now a threat to the people of Egypt. And we think that this is a story that's 3,500 years old. This is a story that continues to this day. Because what happens is they begin to, the people of Egypt and their leadership begin to demonize those who are the ones who came in, who were in fact invited in. The demonization of the other, we heard in the debates last Tuesday, we will hear, I hate to tell you this, for the next 15 months, that's how long it is to the next presidential election, you are going to hear these campaign themes in which the other is going to be demonized from one side or the next. We will begin to hear this over and over and over. This is a reality that we will see in today's world. And in this story, Pharaoh decides to act. And he simply says, has a solution that we begin to see even to this day. Make life so miserable for those who have come across the border that they will not want to stay. Make life so miserable that they won't want to stay. Double their work. Do everything that you can, and we will see these suggestions continue to happen this day. And when that doesn't work, apparently they still are strong and they still are prolific. Pharaoh then comes up with another solution, that which we know as genocide. Every male child calls in these two midwives, and he says, and listen, if the Hebrew people are so prolific, there's got to be more than two midwives. So these are probably, what did I decide? These are the UMWAE, the Union of Midwives of Ancient Egypt representatives. And they're called into Pharaoh, and he says, here's what I want you to do. Every girl child that's born, fine. Let them live. Every male child, kill them. Kill them the moment they come out. And the midwives, I'm sure, are in shock and horror, but they nod, and then they don't do it. And when Pharaoh calls them back months, maybe years later, and says, why are there still male children that are being born? I told you to kill them all. They kind of don't tell the whole truth. They kind of don't tell the whole truth in the same way that the village, the people of the village of Les Chambons in France during World War II, a village of 5,000 people underneath the guise of the Vichy government representing the Nazis, hid 3,500 Jewish people and got them to safety, all the while being told, you can't do that, all the while being asked, are you hiding Jews? And they would go, no, no. 3,500, an entire village working together. So these leaders of the Union of Midwives of Ancient Egypt say to Pharaoh, you know, it's kind of your fault, Pharaoh. You're working us so hard that these women are so strong and so vigorous that they give birth before we can even get there. So Pharaoh, like many a strong man today, doubles down. Evil will do that. So Pharaoh doubles down and he says, okay, then every male child I just want thrown into the Nile. Every male child, throw him into the Nile. And so a male child is born. And he is indeed thrown into the Nile, but in a basket lined with tar so that the basket will not sink. Think about where we are in this story right now. Are there superheroes? There are two women who are midwives who have a kuleana, have a right, a responsibility, a gift. Their gift to bring life into this world, and all they have done is make sure that they do their gift. They are not brandishing a sword. They do not have a spear. They are not getting in Pharaoh's face. They are simply doing that which they are gifted at. And if we are creating a puzzle of that which is light and love in our world, theirs are the pieces that are holding this puzzle together right now. At the moment in which the dictum has gone out, that now every male child is to be thrown into the river, their work is done. Their puzzle pieces have been placed into the puzzle. And now it's the sister, and the mother. Miriam is the sister and the mother. I don't know why I can never remember her name. Jochebed. She's not in this biblical story, but she appears later. Miriam, the older sister of this baby boy floating in a basket down the Nile, and Jochebed, the birth mother of this baby boy floating down the Nile. It's now their turn. It's now their turn to be on the hero's journey. They put the baby in the basket. The basket floats down to where they know it will stop, where the river pools and where the daughter of Pharaoh will be bathing. They have seen this before. They also know that the daughter of Pharaoh may be very different than her father, because she sees a child and she says, this must be a Hebrew child. And instead of therefore taking the baby out and throwing it into the water, out of the basket, she takes the baby out of the basket and holds the baby. Three women now in this story doing that which is their gift, their kuleana, the older sister who has helped to put the baby into the Nile. Pharaoh's daughter who has taken the child out, and then the older sister appears and says, would you like me to find someone who can nurse this child, who can care for this child? And Pharaoh's daughter looks at her and says, can you do that? And she says, well, of course. She takes the child now to her mother, the child's birth mother, Jochebed, and Jochebed begins to raise this child until the time comes when Pharaoh's daughter takes the child into the palace. Three women laying down their puzzle pieces. Notice, there's no superheroes here. There's no big fists that are flying. There's no spears that are being thrown, no knives that are being brandished, no swords that are out. There's simply three people doing their kuleana, their responsibility. And because of them, because the real hero's journey that we all know about is that of Moses, Moses has the opportunity to do that which will eventually lead him to the point where he will go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. But Moses never says those words. If the midwives, if his older sister, if his mother, if Pharaoh's daughter had not laid down their puzzle pieces. The world then, the world now, clamored for heroes. We have had examples of heroes, who people whose lives have been writ large across the universe. People like Martin Luther King, Wangari Maathai, people like Cesar Chavez, people like Jane Goodall, these amazing people whose lives have shaped our world, but they do not get to shape the world without thousands, millions of other people doing their small piece of the puzzle of light and love that we are invited to be a part of. Rebecca, can we have that next slide up, please? Yesterday, tens of thousands of people converged here in Washington, D.C. Yesterday was the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington, D.C. Somewhere, I think, maybe right around here, Kirsten, is a little 2-year-old girl sitting on the shoulders of her father, my wife, there at the March in Washington, D.C. 60 years ago, yesterday, tens of thousands of people, this was a couple hundred thousand people, were there again to remember that March on Washington, D.C., remember when it was that Dr. King gave a speech that I have a dream. Think about what it takes for 200,000 people to descend in this one place so that one man can stand up and give words to the nation's soul that will begin to define the civil rights movement and who we know we are called to be. Think about the organizers that were required to make that happen, to schedule the buses from across the country to come in there, to make the placards, to make the signs, to make sure, and this is without the internet, this is without being able to connect immediately across time zones, and to make this happen so on that one day, at that one moment, 200,000 people from around the world, from around the nation, can be in this one place and hear this one man say, I have a dream. Think of the meals. Think of the food that was required in order for this to happen, because our souls, for them to be fed, requires our bodies to be fed as well. Made me think about this. Next slide, please, Rebecca. You may not know these two brothers, Robert and James Paschal. They had a restaurant in Atlanta in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. In that restaurant in Atlanta is where all the leaders of the Southern Leadership, the Southern Conference, SLNCC, would gather together to begin to make the plans for the marches that would happen, the actions that would happen. These brothers made sure that all of those people, Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, Hosea Williams, John Lewis, Andrew Young, made sure they were fed, and they were fed for free so that they could sit there and they could eat. And I love this. Listen to the diet. Listen to the menu: fried chicken, catfish, fried green tomatoes, collards, and mac and cheese. As much as they needed in order to fuel their minds and their spirits to plan the civil rights movement. But the brothers did far more than that. The brothers were also the people that would post bonds for those who had been arrested, protesters that had been arrested. And they would serve complimentary meals and extend the hours to provide a central location where parents and friends could greet their loved ones after a release from jail. It was one of the few places in a land of still segregated worlds that black and white would in fact come together to meet for one place. Or there's this woman, Georgia Gilmore. It's an older picture from when she was first trained as a midwife, and B, was a person that also worked in a lunch counter in Montgomery in the late 1950s, in 1956, when the Montgomery bus boycott was happening. And she was a supporter of the bus boycott, and so she got fired from her lunch counter job, and so she instead opened an impromptu restaurant in the back of her home so that all the people, Martin Luther King and others, could have a place to come and eat. And then she began to organize the Club from Nowhere. Love the name. The Club from Nowhere, a group of women who would sell baked goods. The proceeds went for gasoline and station wagons that ferried the people around Montgomery, making it possible for them to boycott the segregated bus system. The Paschall brothers, George Gilmore, all these, Virginia Gilmore, all these amazing people, small little pieces of the puzzle, small little pieces of the puzzle that are laid down in such a way that the puzzle of light and love that we all are a part of gets to come into picture, gets to come into focus. Just this week, Kirsten and I had a conversation with a friend of ours who's been involved since the first day on the unfolding tragedy on Maui. His is a kuleana. His kuleana is his team was invaluable in identifying every single vehicle that had been burned, therefore being able to tell the rescue teams where you need to go, as there may be someone there. Every structure that had been destroyed were located, and where the resources of recovery could be most effectively directed. That's his gift. That's what he does. He did it well and had his whole team there. But he called us up because he said, I recognize that that's only one piece of what needs to happen. And he says to us, we need more capabilities related to the spiritual and faith-based protocol for responders and those involved in mediation and community recovery. He understood that the recovery for the people of Maui is one, a long-term picture, and that the recovery is not one thing but many things. And though he has gifts and technology and skills to be able to help at one level, it is only a piece. It's only a piece of the puzzle being put together. And here's the reality. Here's the reality is we may, as a people, clamor for those major figures like Dr. Martin Luther King, who will look large on our horizon in our world, will inspire us, will put word to our souls. But those centerpieces, the center cannot hold without all the other pieces around that support that centerpiece that make up the whole picture. In amongst us here right now may well indeed be the people that at one time or another may be the ones that will appear in the headlines, may be the ones that will gather folks together and will be today's superhero, but for the most part that will not be us. For the most part, instead, we will each be engaged in our own hero's journey over and over and over, in which we are being given the opportunity to use our kuleana, use our gifts, use the rights, the responsibilities that have been given to us, our passions, and do them in such a way to make life better. On Maui, many of us here just 30, 40, 50 miles away are struggling with what can we do to help. But the truth of the matter is at this moment, All the help that some of us may be able to give is in our pocketbook. All the help that some of us may be able to give is in our prayers. But a month from now, 2 months from now, who knows what is the gift that you have that may be the gift that is going to be needed then? What God calls us to is not to always be the one that can come in like a superhero right at the moment, but instead to know that which we are passionate about, that which is our gifts, that which is our kuleana, and to be ready to offer it, as Mother Teresa says, to offer that gift in love again and again and again. That's what those two midwives did. That's what Miriam did. That's what Jochebed did. That's what Pharaoh's daughter did. They all offered their gift at just the moment, which then allowed, ultimately, for the liberation of the Hebrew people from Egypt a generation or so later. May we be the same kind of people, ready to offer our own gifts. Amen.